Okay, let's unpack this. We have a fascinating stack of sources here, and they're mixing scripture, ancient history. We're talking Josephus, Tacitus.
The big ones.
The really big ones, yeah. And also some critical early commentary, like the footnotes from the 1560 Geneva Bible.
Which is a source people often overlook, but it's incredibly insightful.
It really is. So, look, this isn't just a theological study. We're treating this as a chronological investigation.
A historical deep dive.
Exactly. Our mission today is to synthesize what these sources say about the timing of major prophetic events and, well, to ask the big question. What if the clock ran out nearly 2,000 years ago?
It's a compelling mission because, you know, the source material, it directly challenges the timeline that I think most of us grew up with.
Right.
We're looking at an interpretation that says several critical biblical prophecies. I mean, the return of Christ, the judgment of the great city were fully realized.
In the past.
Yes, within the generation that witnessed Jesus's ministry. And it all culminates in that catastrophic event, the Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 73 AD.
That's a massive claim. And it seems like it all hinges on one concept, doesn't it? The idea of immediacy.
All about immediacy.
Because if we take the words of Christ and the apostles literally, you know, that these things would happen quickly and soon.
Right.
Then waiting 2,000 years, that suggests something is off. Either a massive failure of prophecy or maybe a fundamental misunderstanding of the time frame on our part.
Exactly. The source centers on reconciling God's faithfulness with that language of urgency you find all over the New Testament. If Jesus promised these things would happen quickly, then we have to look really critically at that period immediately after the crucifixion.
That 40-year window.
That 40-year window leading right up to 70 AD.
So, to guide our deep dive, we've got a clear path. We're going to start with the theological necessity for all this, the huge shift from the Old Covenant to the New. Then we'll zoom in on the specific time limit Jesus himself set, what this generation shall not pass away, actually meant to the people hearing it.
Then we get into the history.
Yes. Third, we'll see if history corroborates this timing by looking at eyewitness accounts. Josephus, Tacitus of these, well, these supernatural signs that happened right before Jerusalem's fall.
And finally, we're going to tackle the really complex part, the timeline for the 1,000-year spiritual reign and that mysterious little season from Revelation 20.
It's a lot to get through.
It requires a holistic view. You have to integrate the historical events of 70 AD with the theology of the first century church. It's about reading the New Testament as literature written to that time for that audience about events they were guaranteed to see.
So let's start with that theological bedrock.
Yeah.
The seismic shift that the sources say necessitated this judgment on the old covenant system.
Right.
They draw heavily from Jeremiah 31 and Hebrews 8 to make a really strong point.
Right.
Two covenants just cannot coexist in authority. The new covenant, established by Christ, inherently made the old one obsolete.
This point is absolutely crucial. I mean, you can't overstate it. When Christ died, the new covenant was theologically established. Full stop. The old system?
The animal sacrifices. The priesthood.
Exactly. The Aaronic priesthood. The temple itself. It was, in effect, rendered null and void from a spiritual standpoint.
But the buildings were still standing.
The buildings were still standing. The infrastructure, the temple system, the Jewish nation state, it all kept operating for another 40 years.
Which the source material calls what?
The last days, or the end of the age. But not the end of the world. It was the final days of the old covenant age.
Okay, so if the new covenant was functionally in place at the cross, the old covenant was just a ticking clock. Was waiting for its physical destruction.
That ticking clock, that's a perfect way to put it. Hebrews 8.13 is so sharp on this point. It says, "In that he saith, a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away."
Ready to vanish away, not slowly fading away.
No, the sources insist this vanishing was not some gradual process over centuries. It was tied directly to a single catastrophic historical event that physically destroyed the very basis of the old covenant.
The temple.
The temple. The physical operating heart of the law. The destruction in 70 AD was the final, undeniable physical evidence that the old system was officially and irrevocably gone.
Because without a temple.
Without the temple, you have no priesthood, no ritual sacrifices, no central place of pilgrimage. The whole system ceases to exist.
And to understand why that change had to be so abrupt, so violent, really?
Yeah.
We need to look at just how different the two systems were. The sources lay out six key differentiators that made them totally incompatible.
Right. And they're worth walking through. First, the old covenant was temporary. The new was everlasting. The old was given until the seed came, right?
Until Christ.
Until Christ. Second, the old had an external law written on stone tablets.
The Ten Commandments.
Yes. But the new features an internal law, one written on the heart. That change in location alone, from stone to heart, it signifies a complete internalization of our relationship with God. It's revolutionary.
Okay, so that's two. What's the third?
The third is the very basis for the relationship. The old was based on obedience to the law. You know, do this and live.
A works-based system, in a way.
In a way, yes. But the new is based entirely on faith in Christ and his finished work. It's a total paradigm shift.
And the fourth must be about sacrifice.
Of course. The old required repetitive animal sacrifice for temporary atonement. It had to be done over and over. But the new relies on Christ's once-for-all sacrifice, which makes any future animal sacrifices, well, not just meaningless, but actually insulting to what he did.
That makes sense. What's number five?
The mediator changed. The old covenant required priests as intermediaries between God and man. You couldn't just walk into the Holy of Holies.
Right.
The new relies on Jesus as the eternal high priest, giving every believer direct access to God.
And finally, the scope.
The scope. The old was exclusive to physical Israel, based on bloodline, but the new is inclusive to all who believe, Jew and Gentile alike. It fulfills that original Abrahamic promise that all nations would be blessed through his seed.
That distinction, the exclusivity of the old versus the inclusivity of the new, that feels like the linchpin. That's the connection point for the judgment, isn't it?
It is. The covenant had to be transferred from a limited physical bloodline to an unlimited spiritual body of believers. And that transfer provides the context for the judgment that followed, which is illustrated so perfectly in the parable of the wicked tenants.
This is in Matthew 21, Mark 12, Luke 20. It's a really stark story.
It's not just a moral story. The sources are clear that it's a specific localized prophecy about the religious leaders of first century Israel. The landowner is God. The servants are the prophets who Israel rejected and killed.
And the son is obviously Jesus.
Undeniably. And the tenants, the religious authority of the day, they murder the son to claim the inheritance for themselves.
And the punchline of that story is just devastating. The crowd is asked, "What will the owner do?" And Jesus confirms it. He will destroy the wicked tenants and lease the vineyard to others.
It's an explicit prediction of two things that must happen right after Christ's death. One, the vineyard, the covenant, is taken away and given to others.
The multinational church.
Yes. And two, the wicked tenants, the leaders of the old covenant system, are destroyed.
And the source material is adamant. This isn't some abstract spiritual destruction.
No, it's the physical destruction of Jerusalem and the temple system in 70 AD.
Okay, which leads us to what is probably the most controversial point in the source material, identifying Jerusalem itself as the target of judgment, specifically as the infamous Great City and the Whore of Babylon from the book of Revelation.
This takes serious context to unpack. When Jesus denounces Jerusalem in Matthew 23, lamenting, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets."
He's not just expressing sadness.
Not at all. He immediately follows it with a declaration in verse 38. "Behold, your house will be left unto you desolate." Desolate is a word of divine abandonment and physical destruction.
And connecting that declaration of desolation to Revelation, well, that requires a really careful look at the text, doesn't it?
It does. Revelation 11:8 describes the martyrs lying in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified.
Where also our Lord is crucified. I mean, that seems like a pretty clear geographic marker.
It's what the sources call the irrefutable primary marker. Christ was crucified just outside the walls of Jerusalem. The descriptors Sodom and Egypt are spiritual terms for moral corruption and slavery conditions the prophets had long applied to a backslidden Jerusalem. So the sources argue that only Jerusalem fits all the criteria.
But wait a second. Many, many traditional interpretations argue that the great city or the Whore of Babylon has to be Rome, you know, because of its global power when Revelation was written. How did the sources deal with that?
That's a fair and critical question. And the source material counters by saying we need to focus on the theological identity, not just the political one. The Whore of Babylon is described as that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth.
Which sounds like Rome.
Politically, yes. But the woman in that specific context is also described as being drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus.
So the key question is, who was actually killing the prophets and the saints at that time?
Precisely. Historically and scripturally, Jesus himself told Jerusalem that she was the city that killed the prophets. The earliest persecution faced by the apostles came primarily from the Jewish Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, not initially from Roman state power across the empire.
Right, James, Stephen.
James, Stephen, and others were martyred in or near Jerusalem by the religious authorities. So the sources argue that Jerusalem, having reigned spiritually as God's chosen city and having incurred the greatest guilt by killing her own Messiah and the prophets who followed, well, Sheba was the only great city that fit that specific charge of being drunken with the blood of the saints before 70 AD.
That completely reframes the narrative of Revelation. It turns it from a prediction about a distant future empire into an urgent warning, specifically targeted at the coming collapse of the old covenant system.
It does. And underpinning this whole judgment narrative is that terrifying moment during the crucifixion, what the sources call the self-invoked curse of the nation.
This is in Matthew 27, when Pilate is trying to wash his hands of Jesus' blood.
All the people present. And that phrase represents the national will of the time. They replied with those chilling words, "His blood be on us and on our children."
It's a literal national request for cosmic justice, a self-malediction.
And the sources see it as being fulfilled within the generation of the very children they mentioned. They interpret this through the lens of Deuteronomy, the law that says anyone hanged on a tree is accursed of God. By demanding the crucifixion, they were, in effect, calling down that curse upon themselves for rejecting their Messiah.
So the judgment of 70 AD, the slaughter, the starvation, the temple's destruction, the exile, it wasn't just an act of Roman aggression.
Not solely. It's viewed as the direct historical answer to that self-invoked curse. It was the complete fulfillment of the parable, the removal of the tenants and the lease being given to others.
Okay, so we've established the theological necessity. The old covenant had to vanish. Jerusalem was marked for judgment. But now we hit the absolutely critical question.
Yeah.
How quickly did all of this actually happen? And this brings us to what might be the most debated phrase in the Olivet Discourse, the issue of timing.
This is where the immediacy argument really makes its stand. We have to analyze the generational time limit that Jesus imposed in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place.
All these things. That refers to the signs, the temple's destruction, and the coming of Christ in judgment.
Yes. And if that's the case, then the timeline is fixed.
And the sources argue that this generation has to be understood literally. It meant the people who were physically standing there, the audience he was speaking to.
That is the core assertion. Given that Jesus was addressing his disciples and the crowd, this generation must refer to a definable lifespan, which scripturally is often viewed as 40 years.
So the crucifixion was around 30 AD.
Then the maximum timeline for this generation to see all of those signs and the final destruction would be 70 AD. The sources find that alignment to be just too precise to be a coincidence.
And what's really fascinating is that this isn't some new modern interpretation. The historical support for this goes back centuries. The sources cite the 1560 Geneva Bible footnotes. What is the significance of that specific commentary?
The Geneva Bible is incredibly significant. It was the Bible of the Reformation. Shakespeare used it. The Pilgrims brought it to America. Its commentary reflects a very strong tradition of interpreting these prophecies historically, not futuristically.
And what does the specific footnote say about Matthew 24.34?
The footnote on Matthew 24.34 and Luke 21.32 explicitly states, "For within 50 years after Jerusalem was destroyed."
50 years, which perfectly encapsulates that 40-year window from 30 AD to 70 AD.
It does. This confirms that early modern Christian commentators, long before the rise of, you know, modern dispensationalism, understood Christ's promise not as a distant future event, but as a near-term fulfillment that happened within the lifetime of the original audience.
That's crucial external evidence.
It is. It argues against the claim that this text was always meant to span millennia.
Now, Jesus also laid out a prerequisite for these events. The gospel had to be preached to the whole world first, according to Matthew 24.14. For the fulfillment to be immediate, that huge task had to be completed in the first century. Did the apostles actually think they had done that?
They absolutely did. And this is so critical. The sources provide clear proof that the apostles used language that suggests the global mission required for the end of the age had been accomplished in their time. Paul confirms this repeatedly, and he uses the past tense.
Can you give us the specifics?
Of course. In Romans 10:19, Paul quotes the Psalms and applies it directly to the spread of the gospel. He says, "Their voice has gone out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world."
All the earth, meaning the known Roman world.
Exactly. It was a common rhetorical term for the known world, which was the limit of their mission field. But the most definitive statement is in Colossians 1.23. Paul writes that the gospel has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven.
Has been proclaimed. Past tense.
Past tense. Paul is stating that the prerequisite for the end preaching the gospel to their known world was finished before 70 AD. This really pulls the rug out from under one of the major modern arguments for prophetic delay, the idea that the gospel has to reach every single isolated tribe on earth first.
According to Paul, that box was already checked.
The box was checked. This completes the scriptural checklist for an immediate fulfillment.
Let's pivot to a related immediacy claim that the sources challenge. It's the meaning of the transfiguration. Jesus promised his disciples in Matthew 16.28 that some who are standing here will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom.
Right. And many traditionally interpret this as being fulfilled just 6 to 8 days later when Peter, James, and John saw the transfiguration on the mountain.
But the source material says there's a big logical flaw there.
A significant logical flaw. Think about it. If the promise was fulfilled just 8 days later, then the phrase, some who are standing here will not taste death, is, well, it's meaningless.
Because pretty much everyone would still be alive a week later.
Exactly. Why would Jesus specify some would live to see it? It's not a meaningful limitation. It doesn't make any sense.
But if you apply the generation timeline, that 40-year window until 70 AD, it suddenly becomes a logical statement.
It becomes a statistically meaningful statement. Within 40 years, many in that crowd, especially the older ones, would have passed away. But others, like the younger disciples, John, for example, would have survived to witness the catastrophic event of Jerusalem's fall.
So the sources are saying that the fall of Jerusalem was the true fulfillment of Christ coming in his kingdom.
Not a spiritual coming, but a coming in judgment upon the old covenant structure. A public historical demonstration of his authority, not a private vision on a mountaintop.
And that interpretation is reinforced by how urgent and practical the warnings were that Jesus gave.
The warnings were not abstract theological concepts. They were tactical survival instructions.
He told them to take heed to yourselves, lest that day come upon you unexpectedly.
And the most famous instruction, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, flee to the mountains.
Think about that for a second. If these events were for a generation 2,000 years in the future, that specific physical escape advice is completely useless to the people Jesus was talking to.
Why would he terrify them and tell them to run if the danger was centuries away?
He wouldn't.
The sources emphasize that Christ's warnings were for their direct, immediate action. To believe otherwise implies that the primary audience was either intentionally misled or deceived about the urgency.
And the source material provocatively links this widespread belief in prophetic delay, this idea that God's quick promise has been postponed, back to the very first deception in the Bible.
Genesis 3.4, the serpent's suggestion.
You will not certainly die.
Exactly. The source suggests a pattern where people doubt God's intended time frame or meaning. If Jesus declared 5 times in Revelation, "Surely I am coming quickly," and 2,000 years have passed, the only way to maintain the integrity of that divine language is to conclude that the events did occur quickly for the generation that was being addressed. Quick, relative to the lifespan of the person hearing it in the first century.
Okay, this shift in context is really empowering because it allows us to bridge that gap between scriptural interpretation and verifiable history. We're moving from just theology to the battlefield, looking for physical evidence that the generation Jesus spoke to actually saw these promises fulfilled.
And the historical reality is the Jewish-Roman War, which raged from 66 AD to 73 AD. The sources point out that the siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD took place over a period of about 42 months.
Which directly corresponds to the 42-month period mentioned in Revelation 11.2, a time when the holy city would be trampled by the nations.
The synchronicity is powerful, and the primary witness who tied these physical events to supernatural signs was Flavius Josephus, a Jewish historian who lived through it and documented it in the Jewish War.
And Josephus details 7 specific prodigies, or supernatural signs, that just eerily mirror the predictions Jesus gave. This is where it gets really interesting.
It's not just Josephus recounting unusual weather. These are phenomena that align perfectly with the prophetic imagery of judgment. We have to detail these 7 signs because they really form the historical backbone of this entire interpretation.
Okay, let's take them one by one. First, what did he report seeing in the sky?
Josephus reports seeing a star resembling a sword which stood over the city and a comet that continued a whole year.
A sword-shaped star.
Yeah.
and a comet for a whole year. That's not subtle.
Not subtle at all. It's an unmistakable omen of war and destruction, and it directly parallels the signs in the heavens Jesus spoke of and the falling star imagery in Revelation and Matthew.
Okay, second, Josephus notes a shocking event that happened inside the temple itself, the great light.
Yes. During Passover, the most sacred time of year, Josephus claims that so great a light shone around the altar and the holy house that it appeared to be bright daytime, which light lasted for half an hour.
What could that possibly mean?
The sources interpret this as a supernatural warning, a visible manifestation of God's glory physically departing the sanctuary, much like the vision Ezekiel had right before the destruction of the first temple.
Wait, so God's presence, the Shekinah glory, was physically leaving the temple. That implies divine abandonment before the Romans even broke through the walls.
That's precisely the implication. It reinforces Jesus' declaration, "Your house is left unto you desolate." The light was the spiritual withdrawal happening right before the physical catastrophe.
And the third sign, this one is just bizarre. The cow giving birth to a lamb.
A biological impossibility happening during a sacred act of sacrifice. Josephus recorded that a heifer being led to be sacrificed gave birth to a lamb in the midst of the temple.
That's a grotesque omen.
It's a profound sign of impurity and impending divine judgment on the whole ritual system. It suggests that the sacrifices themselves were no longer acceptable.
The fourth sign is truly chilling because it speaks directly to the collapse of the system. The temple gate opens by itself.
And this was not a small door. Josephus describes the eastern brass gate as being so massive that it required 20 men to shut it.
20 men.
And yet, one night, it spontaneously opened. The priests who saw it immediately understood the gravity. They declared that this signal foreshadowed desolation and that the gate was open for the advantage of their enemies. It's a perfect fulfillment of Matthew 23:38, the house opening itself up because God's protection had withdrawn.
Let's move to the fifth sign, because this one aligns with the most recognizable end times imagery armies in the sky. Did Josephus really claim to see phantom soldiers?
He did. He recounts seeing phantom soldiers and chariots in the sky, writing that chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding the cities all over Judea.
I mean, that is a direct physical parallel to Matthew 24, which talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds, and Revelation 19, which depicts Christ leading heavenly armies.
It's astounding. It means the generation Jesus spoke to actually saw what we often think of as these far future abstract visions. They saw heavenly armies mustering in the clouds over their heads.
It just grounds the prophecy so firmly in the first century. So sixth, during the Feast of Pentecost, there was an audible sign.
An audible voice of departure. Josephus documents that the priests heard a supernatural sound from the inner court of the temple, a quaking, and then a sound of a multitude saying, "Let us remove hence."
Let us remove hence. It's the sound of the temple being emptied by the divine presence. That must have been terrifying for the priests.
It was the auditory confirmation of the physical signs. It echoes Ezekiel and aligns with the warning in Revelation 18 to leave Babylon, which the sources identify as Jerusalem, before its destruction.
And finally, the seventh sign, the human prophecy, Jesus ben Ananias.
A genuine historical figure, he was a mad prophet who cried, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem," relentlessly for 7 years straight. He started before the war and didn't stop until he was killed by a stone during the siege. He was a living, breathing, continuous prophecy of doom.
The sheer volume of these aligned signs is just, it's hard to dismiss. But what gives these accounts immense weight is that they were confirmed by Roman sources.
Right, sources that had absolutely no interest in promoting Jewish prophecy or Christian theology.
This is the critical piece of external validation.
It is. The sources reference the Roman historian Tacitus, who independently confirms several of these events in his histories. Tacitus writes about strange phenomena before the siege, including hosts joining battle in the skies, a fiery gleam of arms, and a superhuman voice cried, "The gods are departing."
Wait, Tacitus, a Roman, used the phrase, "The gods are departing."
He did. For the Romans, these things were just terrible omens for the whole region. But the language Tacitus uses perfectly mirrors the "let us remove hence" heard by the Jewish priests.
So it's a widely recognized shared experience.
Yes. It removes any suggestion that these were merely Jewish religious propaganda. These were recognized phenomena of that era.
And crucially, the early church saw this alignment immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Eusebius, the father of church history, he documented how the prophecy was intended for that generation, right?
He documented the famous flight to Pella. Eusebius confirms that the Christians in Jerusalem, commanded by divine revelation, which they recognized through the signs Jesus had foretold, were instructed to leave the city and go to the town of Pella,
fulfilling the command to flee to the mountains.
By taking Christ's warning in Luke 21 and Matthew 24, literally, they were preserved. This act vindicates the interpretation that the prophecy was for them. It was immediate, tangible, and it literally saved their lives.
The whole narrative here is not about a slow decay. It's about a 40-year transition period, ending in a decisive, historical moment of judgment, complete with divine warnings and a clear path of escape for those who believed. So let's now anchor this first century fulfillment into the grander prophetic scheme. We have to talk about Daniel's prophecy of the kingdoms. Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2 laid out the sequence of four empires that would come before Christ's eternal kingdom.
Right. This is crucial for fixing the time when the final judgment had to take place.
So the famous statue, we have the head of gold.
The Babylonian Empire.
The chest and arms of silver.
The Medo-Persian Empire.
The belly and thighs of bronze.
Greek Empire after Alexander.
And then the legs of iron. The fourth kingdom. The mighty Roman Empire.
And the sources focus intently on the final state of that fourth kingdom. The feet and toes, which are described as a mixture of iron and clay.
Okay, we know the iron represents the strength and authority of Rome. But what about the potter's clay? Where does that come from?
This requires a quick dive into prophetic language about Israel. The sources identify the potter's clay as representing Israel, or Judea, the seed of Abraham, particularly the religious and political system of the first century.
And this identification comes from other scriptures?
Yes, directly from earlier references. Jeremiah 18.6 is the classic example. O house of Israel, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in mine hand. Isaiah 64.8 says the same thing. We are the clay, and thou art potter.
So in Daniel's vision, the iron, the world-conquering power of Rome, is mixed with the clay, the volatile and rebellious nation of Judea, which was under Roman rule during Christ's time.
Exactly. So the feet and toes aren't some future global government. They represent the highly unstable mixture of the Roman Empire and the Jewish nation state that existed in the first century.
And this mixture is described as they shall not cleave one to another.
Which perfectly reflects the political reality of first century Judea. The constant insurrections, the rebellions, the zealots, the Roman governors trying to subdue a population that violently rejected assimilation. Rome and Judea were politically mixed, but they absolutely did not cleave together.
And this iron and clay mixture is the final political structure that the stone is prophesied to smash.
Correct. The stone, cut without hands, represents Jesus Christ and his eternal kingdom, and the critical timing is spelled out in Daniel 2.44. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed.
In the days of these kings.
It means the stone's kingdom must have been established when the iron Rome and the clay Judea were both still active political forces. That was the period from 30 AD to 70 AD.
So the fulfillment can't be millennia later when the Roman Empire and the ancient Jewish system are long gone. It has to happen when the feet and toes, the iron and clay mixture, are still standing.
Yes. The stone smote the image on the feet and broke the whole structure at once. It signified the end of the Old Covenant age and the complete establishment of Christ's spiritual reign. The sources maintain that the historical judgment of 70 AD is the only logical fulfillment of Daniel 2.
Okay, if Christ established his spiritual kingdom and Daniel's image was broken in the first century, we now have to turn to Revelation 20, the millennial reign and this strange concept of little season. This is where the timeline gets highly speculative, but the sources try to follow the historical logic.
Right, so we begin with Revelation 20. It describes Satan being bound in the abyss for 1,000 years to keep him from deceiving the nations.
And the sources argue this binding is spiritual, not physical.
Exactly. Before Christ's sacrifice, Satan effectively deceived the entire world, keeping Gentiles in darkness and holding God's people under the law. The establishment of the new covenant and the spread of the gospel is what bound Satan's ability to completely deceive the nations.
And during this 1,000 years, the martyrs reign with Christ, the first resurrection. The sources say this period began right after the destruction of the old covenant system.
70 AD is the starting line. The reigning described in verses 4 to 6 is spiritual. The souls of the martyrs, having overcome the world, are reigning with Christ in the present age. So if the reign began around 70 AD, we add 1,000 years to that.
Which puts the end of the millennial reign around 1076 AD.
Roughly, yes.
So after this 1,000-year period of relative spiritual stability, The chain is broken. Satan is released for a short time or the little season. Deception returns. Evil resurges.
This is the mystery the sources try to unpack. What defines the end of that spiritual reign and the beginning of this short time? They lean heavily on that 1560 Geneva Bible footnote, again, for historical context.
What does that commentary say about Satan being released?
The Geneva footnote suggests the chain is broken when the true preaching of God's word is corrupt by many diverse and fierce enemies of the Church of God, such as the Turks, the Scythians, and others who grievously torment the church.
So it points to a time when great external powers, non-Christian empires or barbarian invasions, rise up and persecute the church, breaking down that peaceful spiritual reign.
That's the idea.
I mean, that sounds a lot like the period of the Crusades, the rise of powerful Islamic empires, and the various calamities that destabilized the Christian world after the 11th century. That aligns pretty well with 1076 AD.
It does. It provides a strong historical candidate for the transition out of the millennial reign and into the little season. The sources also look at other markers, like the events of 536 AD, that period of global darkness, plague, and famine, as perhaps a midpoint crisis or a severe manifestation within the millennium.
Now let's tackle the most speculative element the source material brings up, the timeline for the little season itself. This involves the controversial work of Gunnar Heinsen.
And we must approach this with extreme caution and neutrality, as the sources themselves only suggest investigating it. Heinsen's phantom age theory asserts that the conventional historical chronology from about 230 AD to 930 AD lacks reliable, consistent documentation. He suggests that history during that 7th century period might be chronologically unstable or even partially fabricated.
That is a huge claim. It would collapse centuries of traditional dating. Why would the sources even bring up such a controversial theory?
The source material suggests that if these chronological uncertainties exist, it might impact how long the little season has actually been running. So if we take the start of the little season around 1076 AD, and then we account for a potential compression of time based on investigating Heinsen's 700-year phantom age, well, the sources propose a mathematical connection.
And where does that speculative math lead us?
The speculation suggests that adding 700 years to the calculated end of the millennial reign, 1076 AD, would place a significant chronological marker around the year 1776 AD.
1776.
Yes. The source provocatively suggests that this specific year might signal the start of a period characterized by a renewed wave of global deception and revolutionary anti-Christian fervor Satan's little season in earnest.
That is an astonishing connection to make. And the sources even mention the Statue of Liberty's broken chain as a potential symbol of this.
Yes. They reference the symbolic broken chain at Lady Liberty's feet as potentially signifying the breaking of that spiritual restraint, leading into a period of rampant globalized deception that characterizes the modern age. It is pure speculation, but it shows how thoroughly the sources try to align their thesis with known historical dates.
But regardless of all that chronological speculation, the core issue remains the language of immediacy used all through Revelation.
That's right. If the events were fulfilled quickly in the first century, that language makes perfect sense. But if it applies to us now, 2,000 years later, the words lose all their punch.
Revelation repeatedly stresses urgency. The very first verse says the events must shortly take place.
And in the final chapter, Jesus states it 5 times with incredible emphasis, "Surely I am coming quickly." If Christ truly meant quickly, the sources argue the events must have been fulfilled promptly for the generation receiving that message.
And we can look at the letters to the 7 physical churches, Ephesus, Smyrna, and so on. They were warned of immediate judgment. "I will come to you quickly and remove your lampstand."
Those were tangible historical communities. The sources note that all of those cities have since been destroyed or just vanished. Their judgment was fulfilled in the past, which confirms the urgency of the message. The sources would say it's a fundamental reading error to assume the judgment promised to the physical church in Ephesus 2,000 years ago is still pending today.
So the cumulative evidence, the generational limit, the historical signs, the urgent language, the destruction of the recipients, the theological necessity, it all converges to support this one interpretation.
That the core prophetic events associated with Christ's coming in judgment against the old covenant structure were fulfilled in the first century. The sources present this as the only way to honor the prophetic language of the New Testament without compromising the honesty and immediacy of Christ's warnings to his own audience.
We have taken a truly monumental deep dive here. We've synthesized the theological necessity of the Old Covenant vanishing, the immediate 40-year time frame from this generation, and the striking historical confirmation of signs and destruction from Josephus and Tacitus in 70 AD. It's a powerful, tightly wound argument.
And the key takeaway for you, the learner, is that these sources overwhelmingly support an interpretation where the judgment on Jerusalem and the definitive shift into Christ's eternal spiritual kingdom were events fulfilled within the lifetime of Christ's contemporaries.
Which radically recontextualizes the New Testament.
It does. It moves the focus from distant future predictions to historical, immediate fulfillment that validated the faith of the first century church.
It demands that we stop reading at hand and quickly as theological placeholders for some time later, and actually take them as genuine, actionable timelines. But as we conclude, the source material leaves us with one last fascinating, provocative thought for you to explore on your own.
The sources suggest that our faith in the current historical timeline might need closer inspection. Specifically, they suggest exploring the thesis put forth by Gunnar Heinsen regarding a potential phantom age. The idea that the period from roughly AD 230 to AD 930 might lack robust, reliable, and consistent documentation.
And why should we care about chronological uncertainty in the early medieval period?
Because if the historical timeline itself is flawed or compressed, it raises a profound question. It asks whether prophetic fulfillment, including the spiritual millennial reign and the subsequent release of Satan for the little season, may have occurred much closer to those initial first century events than our current accepted chronology allows.
So the sources invite you to mull over how history and chronology are documented.
And to ask whether perceived prophetic delays are actually rooted in historical dating ambiguities. Go look into those chronological uncertainties and see what you find about the ages of iron and clay.